الشباب والشعب رصاصي يوم الوغايس والعدا مرساسي
So that concludes this week's edition of Gray Matters. We'll be back next week with another hour-long presentation from Alternative Radio down in Boulder, Colorado. Coming up is...
Hi, this is Angela Davis. You're listening to CKUT 90.3.
Angela, you're one of a million.
Good evening and welcome to the November 30th edition of Dramatext. Tonight we have the work of two extraordinary American poets. The first, Rita Dove. She's author of a number of books, including a verse novel, Thomas and Beulah, published in 1986, which garnered the Pulitzer Prize, On the Bus with Rosa Parks, published in 1999, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, and Sonata Mulatakia, which treats historical events with a personal touch, addressing her grandparents' life and marriage in the early 20th century Ohio and the battles and triumphs of the civil rights era. She's received numerous awards, including the Wallace Stevens Award from the Academy of American Poets, the Heinz Award in the Arts and Humanities, the Commonwealth Award, and the National Humanities Medal. She's currently a professor of English at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. The presentation that we're hearing tonight is from the University of California poetry series, television series, and following the work of Rita Dove, we'll hear the work of Talia Moss. She author of a number of acclaimed collections include Wannabe Hoochie, Mama Gallery of Realities, Red Dress Code, New and Selected Poems, Tokyo Butter, Last Chance for the Tarzan Holler, 1999, Small Congregations, New and Selected Poems in 1993, Rainbow Remnants in the Rock Bottom Ghetto Sky of 1991, and At Red Bones in 1990. She is also a winner of the Doers Profiles Performance Award, and she works and lives in Michigan. So here they are, Rita Dove and Talia Moss.
The following program contains adult language and themes and is intended for mature audiences. Viewer discretion is advised.
In 1937, the Dominican Republic. The dictator at the time was Rafael Trujillo, known for his arbitrary cruelty, as well as some rather ordered cruelty. On this particular day in October, the general decides to execute 20,000 Haitian blacks, blacks who came across the border to work side by side with the Dominicans in the cane fields. And the only problem was he didn't know quite how to distinguish the Haitians on sight from the Dominicans. But the Haitians spoke a Spanish in which they did not roll their R's because of the Creole French. When they did speak Spanish, they could not trill that R. And so instead of saying something like Catarina, they would say Catalina. So the general decided to choose a word in Spanish that had an R in it and to have the cane workers come up and, in this rather horrific shibboleth style of execution, have them pronounce this word, and those who said it correctly lived, and those who did not, in effect, had pronounced their own death sentence. This poem is in two parts, and each part has a title. Parsley, the cane fields. There is a parrot imitating spring in the palace, its feathers parsley green. Out of the swamp, the cane appears to haunt us, and we cut it down. El General searches for a word. He is all the world there is. like a parrot imitating spring. We lie down screaming as rain punches through, and we come up green. We cannot speak an R. Out of the swamp, the cane appears, and then the mountain we call in whispers, Catalina. The children gnaw their teeth to arrowheads. There is a parrot imitating spring. El General has found his word, Perejil. Who says it lives. He laughs, teeth shining out of the swamp. The cane appears in our dreams, lashed by wind and streaming. And we lie down. For every drop of blood, there is a parrot imitating spring. Out of the swamp, the cane appears. The Palace. The word the generals chosen is parsley. It is fall, when thoughts turn to love and death. The general thinks of his mother, how she died in the fall, and he planted her walking cane at the grave, and it flowered, each spring stolidly forming four-star blossoms. The general pulls on his boots. He stomps to her room in the palace, the one without curtains, the one with a parrot in a brass ring. As he paces, he wonders, who can I kill today? And for a moment, the little knot of screams is still. The parrot, who has traveled all the way from Australia in an ivory cage, is coy as a widow, practicing spring. Ever since the morning his mother collapsed in the kitchen while baking skull-shaped candies for the Day of the Dead, the general has hated sweets. He orders pastries brought up for the bird. They arrive dusted with sugar on a bed of lace. The knot in his throat starts to twitch. He sees his boots the first day in battle, splashed with mud and urine as a soldier falls at his feet, amazed how stupid he looked at the sound of artillery. I never thought it would sing, the soldier said, and died. Now the general sees the fields of sugar cane lashed by rain and streaming. He sees his mother's smile, the teeth gnawed to arrowheads. He hears the Haitians sing without R's as they swing the great machetes. Catalina, they sing, Catalina, mi madre, mi amor en muerte. God knows his mother was no stupid woman. She could roll an R like a queen. Even a parrot can roll an R. In the bare room, the bright feathers arch in a parody of greenery as the last pale crumbs disappear under the blackened tongue. Someone calls out his name in a voice so like his mother's, a startled tear splashes the tip of his right boot. My mother, my love in death. The general remembers the tiny green sprigs men of his village wore in their capes to honor the birth of a son. He will order many this time to be killed for a single beautiful word. Thank you. I'd like to read you a few poems from my latest book, Mother Love, that Quincy mentioned. This book is loosely based on the story of Demeter and Persephone. And I say loosely because the poems don't remain in the classical time or space, but move all through time and in all sorts of countries and all sorts of situations as it explores mother and daughter relationships. As you remember, the story of Persephone and Demeter is one of the few in the Greek pantheon of stories where a person, a goddess, actually defies the main god, Zeus, and gets away with it. In fact, I think it might be the only time, and it was a woman who did this. What she did was that when after her daughter was kidnapped, snatched underground by the god of the underground, Hades, She began to mourn, and because Demeter was the goddess of the earth, when she mourned, the earth began to die. And the other gods came and tried to convince her to you know, come back, go back to work. She simply went on strike until Zeus had to go to his brother, Hades, and said, maybe you better give the girl back. Only at that point did Demeter begin again to allow the earth to grow. I'll stop right there with the story and interject a little bit more later, but I'd like to begin with the very first poem of the book, which is one of the few stories, one of the few poems in the book, which is actually from the male's point of view. It's called Heroes. I always thought that most of our heroes are become heroes because they suddenly find themselves in a place, you know, at the right time or the wrong time, depending on how you look at it. And they simply realize this is their moment. They just have to do it, be it good or bad. Heroes. A flower in a weedy field. Make it a poppy. You pick it. Because it begins to wilt, you run to the nearest house to ask for a jar of water. The woman on the porch starts screaming. You've plucked the last poppy in her miserable garden, the one that gave her the strength every morning to rise. It's too late for apologies, though you go through the motions, offering trinkets and a juicy spot in the written history she wouldn't live to read anyway. So you strike her, she hits her head on a white boulder, and there's nothing to be done but break the stone into gravel to prop up the flower in the stolen jar you have to take along, because you're a fugitive now, and you can't leave clues. Already the story's starting to unravel, the villagers stirring as your heart pounds into your throat. Oh, why did you pick that idiot flower? Because it was the last one, and you knew it was going to die. Let me read you one from that splits the times between the classical myth and a more modern take on it. Persephone falling. You know, Persephone went out into the fields to pick flowers, an innocent activity, when she was kidnapped. Persephone falling. One narcissus among the ordinary, beautiful flowers, one unlike all the others. She pulled, stooped to pull harder, when, sprung out of the earth on his glittering, terrible carriage, he claimed his due. It is finished. No one heard her. No one. She had strayed from the herd. Remember, go straight to school. This is important. Stop fooling around. Don't answer to strangers. Stick with your playmates. Keep your eyes down. This is how easily the pit opens. This is how one foot sinks into the ground. A lot of these poems are sonnets. One should never say never, and I thought that I would never be writing a lot of sonnets, and as it turns out, they're mostly sonnets or variations on sonnets. Again, fairly loose sonnets. That same scene, but from Persephone's point of view, from the daughters. The narcissus flower. I remember my foot in its frivolous slipper, a frightened bird. Not the earth unzipped, but the way I could see my own fingers and hear myself scream as the blossom incinerated. And though nothing could chasten the plunge, this man adamant as a knife easing into the humblest crevice, I found myself at the center of a calm so pure it was hate. The mystery is, you can eat fear before fear eats you. You can live beyond dying and become a queen whom nothing surprises. Thank you. Thank you. You might remember from the story that when Zeus talks to his brother Hades and says, you've got to give the girl back, Right before Persephone goes back up above ground to join her mother again, she eats 6 pomegranate seeds. And because she had eaten something in hell, the rules were that she could not return above ground forever, but had to keep coming back to the underground 6 months out of the year, half of the year, which is why we have winter and fall when she returns to underground. But you know, the question I always wondered about was why, if she wanted to get back to her mother so badly, did she stop and eat those 6 pomegranate seeds? And my daughter is 13 now, and she's, you know, kind of ready to grow and go. And I realized one day, she came into my room, I was writing on these poems, and she knew I was working on them, and she had been studying the Greek myths in school, and she came to the room with a book opened up to the myth, and she goes, "You've been writing about us, haven't you?" Walked out again, that was all I could write that day. But I realized, too, that perhaps there was more than one side of the story, and that perhaps Persephone really wanted to get away from home as well. This poem is called Wiederkehr, which is a German word for the return, but it's also a word for something that returns again and again. Wiederkehr. Persephone is speaking. "He only wanted me for happiness, to walk in air and not think so much, to watch the smile begun in his eyes end on the lips his eyes caressed. He merely hoped, in darkness, to smell rain, and though he saw how still I sat to hold the rain untouched inside me, he never asked if I would stay, which is why, when the choice appeared, I reached for it." This next poem, is a group of sonnets, a sequence of sonnets. It's a departure from the myth. In this one, in fact, I have the mother coming to convince her daughter to return, and the underworld, or hell, is the city of Paris. That's not what I really think of Paris. I really love Paris, but I thought it was appropriate kind of hell for a mother. You know, if she thought her daughter had disappeared into it, especially if the man in question was a mediocre artist. "The bistro sticks." The mother is speaking. "The bistro sticks. She was thinner, with a mannered gauntness as she paused just inside the double glass doors to survey the room, silvery cape billowing dramatically behind her. 'What's this?' I thought, lifting a hand until she nodded and started across the parquet. That's when I saw she was dressed all in gray, from a kittenish cashmere skirt and cowl down to the graphite signature of her shoes. 'Sorry I'm late,' she panted, though she wasn't, sliding into the chair, her cape tossed off in a shudder of brushed steel. We kissed. Then I leaned back to peruse my blighted child, this wary, aristocratic mole. 'How's business?' I asked, and hazarded a motherly smile to keep from crying out, 'Are you content to conduct your life as a cliché and, what's worse, an anachronism, the brooding artist's demi-monde?' Near the Rue Princesse, they had opened a gallery come souvenir shop which featured fuzzy off-color Monets next to his acrylics, no doubt, plus bearded African drums and the occasional miniature gargoyle from Notre Dame the great artist had carved at breakfast with a pocket knife. Tourists love us. The Parisians, of course," she blushed, "are amused, though not without a certain admiration. The Chateaubriand arrived on a bone-white plate, smug and absolute in its fragrant crust, a black plug steaming like the heart plucked from the chest of a worthy enemy. One touch with her fork sent pink juices streaming. Admiration for what? Wine, a bloody Pinot Noir, brought color to her cheeks. Why, the aplomb with which we've managed to support our art. meaning he'd convinced her to pose nude for his appalling canvases, faintly futuristic landscapes strewn with car wrecks and bodies being chewed by rabid cocker spaniels. "I'd like to come by the studio," I ventured, "and see the new stuff." "Yes, if you wish." A delicate rebuff before the warning. He dresses all in black now. Me, he drapes in blue and carmine, and even though I think it's kind of cute, in company I tend toward more muted shades. She paused and had the grace to drop her eyes. She did look ravishing, spookily insubstantial, a lipstick ghost on tissue, or as if one stood on a fifth-floor terrace peering through a fringe of rain at Paris's dreaming chimney pots, each sooty issue wobbling skyward in an ecstatic, oracular spiral. And he never thinks of food. I wish I didn't have to plead with him to eat. Fruit and cheese appeared, arrayed on leaf-green dishes. I stuck with café crème. "This camembert's so ripe," she joked, "it's practically grown hair, mucking a golden glob complete with parsley sprig onto a heel of bread." Nothing seemed to fill her up. She swallowed, sliced into a pear, speared each tear-shaped lavalier, and popped the dripping mess into her pretty mouth. Nowhere the bright tufted fields, weighted vines, and sun poured down out of the south. "But are you happy?" Fearing, I whispered it quickly. "What? You know, Mother," she bit into the starry rose of a fig, "one really ought to try the fruit here." "I've lost her," I thought, and called for the bill.
Thank you.
Demeter waiting. No. Who can bear it? Only someone who hates herself, who believes to pull a hand back from a daughter's cheek is to put love into her pocket, like one of those ashen Christian philosophers or a war-bound soldier. She is gone again, and I will not bear it. I will drag my grief through a winter of my own making and refuse any meadow that recycles itself into hope. Shit on the cicadas, dry meteor flash, finicky butterflies. I will wail and thrash until the whole goddamn golden panorama freezes over. Then I will sit down and wait for her. Yes.
That's a hand.
Another more contemporary one. Used. The conspiracy is to make us thin. Size threes are all the rage, and skirts ballooning above twinkling knees are every man-child's pre-adolescent dream. Tabula rasa. No slates that clean. We've earned the navel's sunken grief when the last child emptied us of their brief interior light. Our muscles say we have been used. Have you ever tried silk sheets? I did, persuaded by postnatal dread and a Macy's clerk to bargain for more zip. We couldn't hang on, slipped to the floor, and by morning the quilts had slid off too. Enough of guilt. It's hard work staying cool. Thank you. Thank you. I'd like to end with two poems that deal more directly with my daughter. She's made me promise not to ever read this as long as I'm within 50 miles of her. That was our agreement, and since I'm a little bit further, I live in Virginia, I can read this tonight. This poem was written about the time when she was at that age when children love to hear stories read over and over and over again, and you better not try to switch around the words. And the book in question is Marie Sendak's Mickey in the Night Kitchen. After reading Mickey in the Night Kitchen for the third time before bed, and there's an epigraph, I'm in the milk and the milk's in me. I'm Mickey. My daughter spreads her legs to find her vagina. Hairless, this mistaken bit of nomenclature is what a stranger cannot touch without her yelling. She demands to see mine, and momentarily we're a lopsided star among the spilled toys, my prodigious scallops exposed to her neat cameo. And yet the same glazed tunnel, layered sequences. She is three. That makes this innocent. We're pink, she shrieks and bounds off. Every month she wants to know where it hurts and what the wrinkled string means between my legs. This is good blood, I say, but that's wrong too. How to tell her that it's what makes us, black mother, cream child, that we're in the pink and the pink's in us. Thank you. And I'd like to end with a very recent poem, although the situation it described happened even before the last one. My daughter is 13 now, and this happened in the hospital where she was born. Sometimes it takes a long time to get a poem out. We had a midwife in the hospital who was a magnificent creature. She was very, very tall, over 6 feet, very dark, very long hair, and she seemed to know everything. If we had, Miles Davis on, she would know what, you know, where it was, where this live performance had been taped. If it was Randy Newman, she knew the song. If it was Bach, she knew what cantata it was. And we wondered, though, what was she? Because we could not place her. And finally, after a couple of days, we placed her, and we took it as a good omen for our own little potpourri child. She was born in Phoenix, Arizona, hence the title, Incarnation in Phoenix. Into this paradise of pain, she strides on the slim tether of a nurse's bell, her charcoal limbs emerging from crisp whites, unlikely as an envelope issuing smoke. I've rung because my breasts have risen, Cartesian. I'm not ready for this motherhood stuff. Her name is Raven, and she swoops across the tiled wilderness, hair boiling thunder over the rampart of bobby pins spoking her immaculate cap. She dips once for the baby just waking, fists punching in for work right on schedule, bends again to investigate what should be natural, milk pouring into one tiny vociferous mouth. Ah, she whispers, ambrosia. Shaming me instantly. But no nectar trickles forth, no manna descends from the vault of heaven to feed this pearly syllable, this package of leafy persuasion dropped on our doorstep and ripening before us, a miniature United Nations. Just like me, Raven says, citing the name of her mother's village somewhere in Norway, her father, a buffalo soldier. Now, of course, we can place her, an African Valkyrie, who takes my breast in her fists, grunting, this hurts you more than it does me. Then my laugh squeezed to a whimper, and the milk running out. Thank you.
listening to CKUT 90.3 on the FM dial. This is Droma Text. We're here once a week with the spoken word. We just heard a 30-minute presentation of the work of Rita Dove. And this next poet we'll hear is another 30-minute presentation of the work of Thalias Moss. Both of these readings have come from courtesy of the University of California television series. And you can check them out over the World Wide Web. Here's Thalias Moss.
There are probably some of you here who think I have come to read poems. I have not. Let me clear up a nagging misunderstanding. This is the way to make the white woman's bed. She thinks I make it because she is rich. She thinks I make it to get her money. That I can't get money any other way. No skills, no intelligence, no contribution to society but for her four-poster. But I make her bed because on Judgment Day, you will have to sleep in the bed you made. Make damn good ones, but she didn't make any. And now that we've cleared up the misunderstanding, I'll read some poems. Water Road. Sing a song of commerce for the long, long ride. Setting out from Dahomey and smelling well the first day. The sea, sea, sea I love. And tracing with my finger fine outline of grayish bird now diving, now rising from the water. A fist of feathers and beak to shackle a fish doing the shimmy shimmy. Crew says, if it wasn't lovely, it'd be cruel. Cargo says, if it wasn't cruel, it'd be lovely. Then I smell too much us. And am close as love on two sides of me, but feel none. My finger still traces, but bird flies too far to seize big, and it look for the water bottom to rest, but there be no end, no bed, no death, no world like used to be. We be deep in the ship, buried alive in the tight, hot, sick world. We be deep and floating on overflowing sickness. We be men knowing down best. We be women on the quarter deck. Knowing crew men know down best when they ram it down our throats instead of tween the legs. Our eyes be like stars, be bright, be looking, be helpless, and hanging in black sickness deep above.
Presenting my work is something I'm very comfortable with. I'm a writer, so when I present my work, I'm not talking at all. I'm just, in some ways, recreating those initial moments when the work came into being. It is performance. I'm not myself. I don't have to represent myself at all. Talking to an audience, I don't understand. I don't think I could do it. I don't consider myself terribly articulate. That's why I write. I do much better writing than I do talking, except for performance, which is different.
Yeah. I could understand God's keeping Satan to himself. You don't share your best thing. Your private stock. Personal ego stroker. But God let the devil loose, he says. Satan didn't just make up his mind to leave, disgusted by the chauvinism, among other things. Let him loose, then hunted him down and bid us praise the staging. The devilish contract to get Satan second banana high and dismissed by jungle terminology. The Joe Johnson against the great white hope of a god. The problem? God's male need for adversary. Worthy opponent. For just short of equal. And that's Satan, the runner-up. Sprinter in the next lane who could have grabbed the gold if he could have afforded it's blinding him. The one who almost had it all. As for God, all glowing is vain. Satan accepts the rest. What rains down the heavenly sewage and trash, the blame for holy wars, rescue rages for every drop of blood, for whatever will not be blessed, the unchosen, the uncola. Some choose for those who do not a second or third world, or third right. In heaven, Satan was a minority in a neighborhood where everyone else was saint. Crosses burned and his car, house, clothes, wings, all his possessions. And the burning and reburning of memories establishes hell. Poor Satan. His authority denied him by a nose. A longer, pointier, Caucasian nose. Where's the gratitude for Satan, who is there for God no matter what? Satan, who is the original Uncle Tom.
What are my themes? How could I possibly say that? You know, if I were to give a list of themes, this would imply that this is somehow the totality of my concerns as a writer. I'm sure that my work to come is going to involve themes that I don't yet know. I have no idea what is going to seem prominent at another time. I'm very much interested in a kind of, I guess, well, at the moment, justice is the word that comes to my mind. And I have a kind of respect for everything, or I work at it, and I work real hard. at trying to garner any kind of respect for things I don't like. But I consider as a possible theme absolutely anything. That is, if I am receptive enough, if I am open enough, I should be able to consider anything that I encounter and find something in it worth commenting on. So, I hope that my themes represent the range of experience, the range of emotion, so that from my work, I would prefer that one gets a sense of, that's right, all of this, you, all of this is involved in living. We need to consider this all. We can't leave out anything. So, certainly, I'm not going to read long enough to make sure that all the bases, so to speak, are covered, but the body of the work, it is range that interests me. So I'll write about anything.
There's a certain phrase I detest, and if you use it, shame on you. The phrase is, well, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. But you know, in this life, it is possible to encounter worse phrases than that. For instance, they can put a man on the moon, so you know that means that they can do well. I'm not sure that those people and I should really share the same planet. But this is my poem about that little phrase, that man on the moon stuff, and it is called Living Under a Man on the Moon. This is how it goes. They can put a man on the moon even if they can't do anything else. She is trying to be grateful. So it's true that anything is possible now. She better get out there and get them while they're hot. They're cooking, they're whistling Dixie while they got the messianic method down cold. Rejoice with me now. They can put a man on the moon. She kicks up her heels, then sets her heels back on ground, less impressive, that someone else put man on. Nothing is the same. She may as well dust with her blouse and not think about how it was assembled in Haiti when the sun was long gone and moonlight provided what it could with a man on it watching. She may as well let the white noise of the French help her with duty. She may as well celebrate while a Haitian girl attaches sleeves and sees the moon through one of them when she dozes. Oh, don't wake her up. Haitian girl doesn't know them or what they can do. It might come as a shock that they can put a man a lot like the man on the stamp, on the money, on the map, on base, on first, on dope, on her nerves. They can put just another man on the moon that doesn't deserve this. The moon that has been faithful as a dog, obedient to the leash of gravity, that lets the man on it be 10 times stronger, be the Hercules that never was. They put a man on the moon,
and everybody but her and the Haitian girl acts a fool and thinks man now has new power. She knows that putting a man on something as easy as the moon, as cheesy as the moon, as vulnerable as the moon, as promiscuous as the moon, binging buxom, then purging coy, then plumping for lack of protection, is nothing to brag about and does not mean talent or genius. They put a man in a rocket and he blasted off and landed on a virgin dead world with a lot of craters that he just took to be openings for his ego, his advancement. She won't make love to a man that plays pool, the cue stick a rocket to a ball of white opportunity.
So I have once said that, and have just said, that I could write about absolutely anything, but I must admit, I have never actually gotten an idea for a poem while reading a poem that already existed. That has not happened. Now, I'm starting to feel badly here. Something is wrong, for I have found something, I don't like to say inspiring, but something meaningful in every form of experience, something that I consider worthy to write about, except that. So never in that. Maybe because that's a moment when I'm particularly conscious of myself, and I don't find myself directly as the source of material. It's that isn't the way I look. So in that context, and perhaps because it is performance in that sense, it's taken to a level that's a little less significant when it is existing as performance, because then it's entertainment more so than the content, the meaning, these powerful issues, the ideology and within the poem. It's a performance, and I'm an entertainer at that time.
The last poem requires that you have a little bit of knowledge about Asafoetida. If you have this knowledge already, then you already know you are blessed. So that the rest of you who don't know it may have blessing extended upon them, I will tell you, it is a marvelous remedy. And if you ever have chance to get some, do so. It is a weed and it stinks. There is probably no stench worse than the odor of Asafoetida. It grows wild, of course, it would be wild. But what you do, you see, you take it and you put it in some kind of waxy chunk and a string around it and wear it with that string tied around your neck. And you will never, ever have another cold. You will never again have to worry about the flu, for everyone will maintain their distance for that smell. That's right. Now you can grind it up and use it in Indian cuisine, where it is, in fact, such a spice. Or in its ground form, you can then make a liquid variety of this medicine. That is what my mother did. And it is just extraordinary. There is nothing it can't cure. I'm happy to say I never missed a day of school. My mother merely pulled out the bottle and just waved it about 20 feet away from me, and I could smell it through the glass, you know, and I was cured. Oh, I was healed by that medicine. So it is not the stink of it that interests me, but rather it is the continuity, the durability of this. It is truly a miraculous substance, it is, and there has only been one bottle in my mother's family for generations. Why, yes, it is true, and if these women did not have to be mortal, Asafoetida would have kept them alive. So, a poem of tribute to Asafoetida, poem for my mothers and other makers of Asafoetida. Brown in the bottle, my
honeyed memory of my grandmother, in which I drench myself, pour over myself one of her tight hugs, homemade gravy on lips and ribs, eventually hips. Taste her, and feast on my church in a bottle, the gospel like Sister Posey sings it. Oh, when will I get home? Looking over Dixie, over Jordan, river of life, needing to cross, already got a cross, needing to swim to Jordan's stormy other shore. Listen, the brown choir's brown liquid voice, my arms moving me through it. Swimming is just directing the choir, giving instructions. Mama always told me to be still sometimes and feel the power. Wait while the river moves down my throat, urine the rest of the miracle that makes of me a fountain. Nasty asafoetida, tastes like the bootleg, jackleg, medicine it is, curing me as only generations can. Asafoetida is a quilt for my inner, she said, up to her neck in gizzards, hocks, pickled pig's feet, her hands good as dull knives that can't have accidents. And everywhere, everywhere, eggs like teeth big as what memory does to grandma, even the heart of gold. Finally, the asafoetida toast just after gunfire. The New Year's shot for coming uninvited ahead of schedule. Years coming and going out of control. Trojan years bringing lots of what we don't want set loose in foreclosed fields of stone potatoes. So hard-hearted, hard-headed, there are no eyes except the ones I look into and fall in love. Right into mama's pupils, the past dark with dense ancestry. All who came before having to fit into the available space of history, which is existence's memory. And year after year, the overcrowding worsens. Remember, remember, darkest before the day, every dog will have. We are dogs sometimes, vestiges of our evolution, giving us dreams, instincts, secrets for dark recall. Nothing, y'all don't hear me, nothing really goes away, especially not that sickening paradox, falling to reach the sublime emotion. Want to rise in love, want a boost, elevator ride to the penthouse, silk jacket smoking with lust, men making it with an asafoetida bottle, a glass, a mama with an excuse for breaking. Whatever sustains you is your mama. That wall holding back wind, jazz on the airwaves and in the Thunderbird, the Boone's Farm, the oar smacking discipline into fish while ferrying you across the water that takes you back to old Virginia. Every visit is return to the scene of crimes. So much happened there, so much history there. Rivers are sad affairs, flowing between past and future, like pampas blue, if sunny, ribbons that must deepen, widen, or spill to really go anywhere. And still there are limits. Disillusionment to cap any growth. Live to the fullest and just have more to lose to death. But Grandma said, Mama says, now I say, maybe possible to have so much. Death can't take it all. A sapphire still on the shelf. Oil in the puddle, still ghetto stained glass, still rainbow remnants in rock bottom ghetto sky, like a promise, no more tears. As I fit in a bottle floating there, woo, some kind of Moses, some kind of deliverer. There's always a way. A way means not here. Place where bagpipes echo with sound of a stuck doll calling, Mama, Mama. Nothing but inspiration in the air and the prophet Jolson proclaiming, Mammy. Asking for her, who can make him wash his face? 'Cause she's the one and the only one who can turn it into something to love. Thank you.
Let's face it, poetry is very rarely on bestseller lists, though that is my dream. Not for my book, just what I'd like is to go into a reading, and first I want thousands of people assembled to hear the poetry. And when the poet is visible, then immediately the audience begins screaming, and they're fighting to get close to the poet, and they want to shave off cells of your skin, you see, so that those from the fingertips, the part of you that held the pens or touched the keyboard, you see, and then from the audience as you're about to read, they yell out, read this poem, or read this, oh please read, one year Sonny stabbed himself, you see. So that's what I want. And there's a, and when you try to leave the stage, the ovation is such, right, that you must come back and read 6 hours more, poem after poem. Well, now, for something like that to happen, then there's going to have to be drastic changes in the way poets read. So.
So me.
So that concludes this week's edition of Dromo Text. You've heard the work of Rita Dove and Talias Moss, two American poets, via the University of California television series. And we'll be back next week with another hour-long presentation of the spoken word.
Yo, check this out, this is Flavor Flav, and you listening to C. Yo, check 1-2, this is Flavor Flav, Public Enemy, and you listening to K. Yo, check 1-2, this is Flavor Flav, Public Enemy, and you listening to CKUT, and the place to be, from the Bronx to T.O.P.
My radio stuck on CKUT, and you don't know, but nah, fix it. CKUT, the number one radio station in Montreal. We give you the sun, the moon, the rain, the stars and the mountain. CKUT give you the word.
Oh, merci beaucoup, Mme Saint-Onge. J'aurais fait l'intro de Francis et les exerciceurs sur les ondes de CKUT Radio McGill. Aujourd'hui, l'émission, je fais jouer des extraits des deux derniers disques de Negative Land, soit l'album The World Will Decide et le triple album Speech Free. Donc, extrait, ça ne rentre pas tout dans l'émission. Et au début, un vieux classique de Negative Land que j'aime. C'est très, très bon, Negative Land, connaissez-vous?
Now, we're up to our long-distance dedication. Dear Casey, this may seem to be a strange dedication request, but I'm quite sincere, and it'll mean a lot if you play it. Recently, there was a death in our family. He was a little dog named Snuckles, but he was most certainly a part of... Let's come start again. From coming out of the record. Play the record, okay? Please.
I can't get no satisfaction. I'm trying to make some girl